Welcome to Next on the Tee with Chris Mascaro, the show where you get the inside access to the best minds in the game. Each week, Chris has the privilege of chatting with top instructors, legendary players, course architects, and industry insiders. If you're looking to improve your game, gain a new perspective, or just hear some incredible golf stories, you are indeed in the right place.
You see, Chris, let me tell you something. I haven't spoken to a press man in my life that is knowledgeable, seriously, as you are. Never.
You do such a great job. It kind of makes me feel good all of a sudden.
You do so much for the game. You're so kind to all of us that are out there in the game. You know, we need more people like you in the game of golf.
Thank you for pressing play. Now, grab your clubs, step up to the tee, and let's get started. This is Next on the Tee.
Hi, folks, and welcome into another edition of Next on the Tee. I'm your host, Chris Mascaro, and this week I'm excited to bring to you three incredible guests. One is a show mainstay, been with me for many, many years. Very grateful to her. Her positivity is always off the charts, plus two guys that are making their Next on the Tee debuts. First up, I'm sure you guessed, is one of my all-time favorites, LPGA Class A teaching professional and top 50 instructor, Debbie O'Connell. Debbie is a trailblazer in our game. She's been named LPGA National Professional of the Year, won the inaugural Nancy Lopez Achievement Award, is the founder of Golf Positive and the author of Golf Positive, Live Positive, and she continues to inspire golfers everywhere she goes through her teaching, her writing, and her Conquer Your Mind golf classes. Those are absolutely outstanding. Just got done with one, so hopefully she'll have some of those coming up in the early parts of next year. But Debbie's passion for helping players strengthen both their swing and their mindset makes her one of the most influential voices in golf instruction today. This time around, we're going to get some tips for how to prepare our minds prior to our round. We don't do that well enough. She's going to give us some tips there. Plus, a quick stretch that we can do that helps us get our bodies prepared for our round. That's something else a lot of times we don't have an opportunity to do because we're racing to get to our tee time. She gives us a couple of quick stretches that'll help us play better. And what we need to do to not embed negative thoughts in our brains during our rounds. We've talked with Debbie for years about the negative self-talk we do and slamming our clubs and telling ourselves that we stink, all those sorts of things. How can we not do that and not embed those negative thoughts? Following Debbie, I'm going to be joined by award-winning journalist and author Hank Gola. Hank's career spans decades covering golf, football, and soccer for outlets like the New York Post and the Daily News. He's won multiple Golf Writer Association of America awards. He's also written three outstanding books, including his most recent one, Ryder Cup Rivals, The Fiercest Battles for Golf's Holy Grail. And we dive deep into several of the matches that he has written about, starting back in 1927 and learning about the impact that Walter Hagen had on bringing money into the game back then. We also talk about the War by the Shore in 1991, one of my favorite Ryder Cup matches, the incredible U.S. comeback in 1999 at the Country Club, and we all remember Ben Crenshaw's incredible speech there, and he accurately, unfortunately, predicts this year's matches as well. Then in part two, comedian and the host of the Reasonably Happy podcast, Paul Olinger, joins me. Paul is hilarious and makes the segment so much fun to be a part of. I know you guys are going to love him. He talks about making the decision to leave his job as a VP at Facebook to start a career as a stand-up comic. Not an easy one, but he talks about how he went through that process. I get his definition on what happiness is and why he thinks it is that Denmark is always ranked number one among the happiest places to live. How toilet paper became a social barometer back during the pandemic. Look, folks, you're not going to want to miss this segment with Paul. It's so much fun. So be sure to come back and press play on part two of this week's show. It's a fantastic episode, folks. I am so thankful that you're here. You decided to press play, and you're taking the journey with me again this week here on the show. All right, but before we continue and get into the rest of the show, I want to start off by giving a shout out to my great friends over at the Pittsburgh Tribune Review. TribLive.com is the leading news website for Western Pennsylvania with news around the clock. Pittsburgh pro sports coverage, a high school sports network, a podcast network, which you can find Next on the Tee on. So go out and bookmark TribLive.com or download the TribLive app for free and stay up to date with all the news in Western Pennsylvania and this show. I also want to talk about our friends over at the Pittsburgh Brewing Company and Iron City Beer, a brand that I have loved my whole life and started drinking when I was 21 years old, of course. Whether you're a hacker or a scratcher, the secret to a successful day on the links is knowing when it's time to grab an iron, even if that means keeping it in the bag till the 19th hole. If it's been a while since you've reached for Pittsburgh staple beer, it's time to revisit Iron City. Thanks to their incredible new facility in Creighton, the best tasting Iron City beer ever made is now available at a course near you. Iron City pairs well with any lye and sky and serves as a friendly reminder that there's always next round. Iron City beer, best enjoyed while enjoying life. And this year, get ready to experience a game like never before at the Keep, the brand new Bill Bergen and Reese Jones co-designed course at Macklemore. Nestled high atop Lookout Mountain, the Keep offers breathtaking vistas that are made even more spectacular as the autumn colors paint the landscape in rich hues of red, orange, and gold. With its challenging layout and awe-inspiring views, every round here is an unforgettable adventure. Whether you're taking on the signature holes or just soaking in the scenery, the Keep is where your best golf meets nature's finest backdrop. So grab your clubs and join us up at Macklemore. The Keep is open for preview play, and it's waiting for you. Okay, now back and next on the tee with me, and I'm humbled to say this, for the 16th time, as you guys know, is not only one of my all-time favorite guests, but also one of my favorite people on the planet, and that is Debbie O'Connell. Debbie is an LPGA teaching professional and a top 50 LPGA instructor. In 2002, she was named both the LPGA National Professional of the Year and the LPGA Southeast Section Professional of the Year as well. In 2004, her high school alma mater, Ridgewood High up in New Jersey, inducted her into their Athletics Hall of Fame. In 2007, she won the inaugural Nancy Lopez Achievement Award, which is given annually to the person who emulates the qualities valued by Nancy, which are leadership, passion, giving, and approachability. In 2016, she was named the Northeast Section Teacher of the Year. She is also the founder of Golf Positive, where she offers multimedia golf tips and articles that are going to enhance both your golf game and your life. She's written a wonderful book titled Golf Positive, Live Positive, Lessons in Golf and Life, which you can go get out on Amazon or listen to out on Audible. And I couldn't be more excited that I get to have her back again with me this week here on Next on the Tee. Hey, Debbie, how are you, my friend?
I am fantastic, Chris. Thank you so much for that awesome introduction. And I always love spending time with you and being here with your audience, which continues to grow and grow. Congratulations on your success.
I appreciate you. Some of that is due to you. 16 times I've had the privilege of spending time with you. I can't thank you enough for how much you've meant to me over the years.
Well, and I can't thank you enough. Wow, I did a double take when I heard that. I was like, 16? I was surprised and very deeply grateful.
All right, so let's start things off this time by talking about a new business venture that you've got started. Talk about Business Golf Live in your new three-day course.
Oh my goodness. You know, for years, Chris, I have used golf for business. I have run corporate golf outing, teaching people how to use golf for business. And I was actually on a marketer's cruise, and I met a gentleman by the name of Tom Matson, a serial entrepreneur, highly successful man. And he talked to me about how he was creating this Lynx Golf Cafe. They're actually indoor golf sites, and he's going to have this business component to it, have a boardroom in there and also a podcast studio and really teach people how to use golf for business. I said, oh my goodness, you're talking my language. And we just connected so well. And we have another partner, Ray Pell, another entrepreneur who has been highly successful. Both have used golf for business. I've used it. I teach it. And we came together and created a program called Business Golf Live. And we couldn't be more excited to sharing it with the world of golfers who are also business people, whether you're in corporate America and you have a book of clients and you want to, one, deepen the relationship with your clients or grow that client book, or an entrepreneur who wants to also meet people of influence, meet people who will help your business, who will be great clients and build those high trust relationships. This course is for you. I haven't been more excited about launching a new course in a long time. And this one has me over the moon excited.
And you've got it coming up here in not too long, right? Beginning of October-ish?
Yes, it's a three-day course, October 8th through the 10th.
For folks that now you've got them excited, okay, you got to tell me more. I got to get involved with this thing. How can they go out and sign up and find out more information?
Yeah, it's go right to our website, businessgolflive.com. Just spell it the way it sounds, businessgolflive.com. Couldn't be any more simple to find us, I'm sure.
And Debbie, one of the other classes, and we've talked about this in previous times that you've been a part of the show, you just hosted one of your Conquer Your Golf Mind classes, which is outstanding. Talk about that. And do you got another one of those coming up this fall?
You know, I don't this fall. I just completed the one, as you said. And, you know, the key there is helping people manage their emotions on the course, control their own thoughts, and really understand to focus on what you can control, not what you can't control. And I love to take it a step deeper. So there's the mental game of golf, right? And then there's mindset. And that's where conquering your golf mind comes in. Because I don't just want to know that you get frustrated and angry, or you lose focus, or you fall apart in a pressure situation, and give you conscious mind strategies to resolve them. I want to understand what's happening in the unconscious mind that's creating so much anger, that creates so much tension. I've had so many clients who grip the club too tightly. And what I find out is they're also control freaks, right? They're like, oh my gosh, I have to be in control in everything I do. And when they loosen up, they feel out of control. Well, there's an unconscious meaning they put to being out of control, and it's not safe, or it's not comfortable for them for whatever reason. And that lies in the unconscious. And once we conquer that, then they can go out and relax and let it swing, create more club head speed, hit the ball farther and straighter, just truly by letting the club swing without being so tight. It's like they're putting the brakes on the whole time.
Debbie, let's switch gears just slightly. One of the age-old complaints about going to the range and practicing has been, no matter how much time I spend there, I never seem to get any better. In your Conquer Your Golf Mind course, you talk about how we need to set aside time to get our minds prepared to play our best golf. Some people might be skeptical about that, but we know how well we play depends on what's going on between our ears. When we get frustrated on the golf course, we're going to throw away any opportunity that we have to shoot a good score that day. Talk about why we may not be seeing the results that we're looking for on the range and on the course because we're not spending the proper amount of time getting our minds right first.
Well, that's a great question. And there's two parts to that. There's the between rounds of golf where you can actually meditate. And some people are like, that's a taboo, Debbie. I'm not going to meditate. That's for other people. I'm not into that. That's woo-woo to me. And it's truly not. When you just visualize your shot, yeah, that's a form of meditation. When you sit quietly and take some deep breaths, that's a form of meditation. But imagine visualizing yourself playing your best golf, looking through your own eyes, seeing what you see, hear what you hear, feel what you feel. And if you're coming down the ninth hole and you smell hot dogs cooking normally, smell what you smell, taste what you taste, right? The more real you can make it, the more your mind will believe exactly what you're doing as real. So it really doesn't know the difference between you visualizing especially when you're looking through your own eyes and you're seeing it the way you would really see it. And if you're actually doing it. So you can literally practice perfectly in your mind. And there's been so much research about this. This is all research-based. And one of the great stories is a gentleman who was a prisoner of war in Vietnam for 7 years. And the thing that helped him survive that horrible time in his life was he played 18 holes of golf in his mind every day. Now, he had plenty of time. The thing about visualizing, we all don't have to take all the time he did. He just wanted to fill his day. So he literally started by picking out clothes in the closet and driving to the course. So he wanted to live the whole experience. But when he came out, he was so malnourished, underweight, and it wasn't much time afterwards that he played in a pro-am, and he shot 76.
Wow.
Now, he had not been practicing. He was barely surviving and, looked like a rail when he went out to play. But the reason he did is every day he played, he shot even par in his mind. So he had that confidence. His brain saw him playing golf every day for 7 years.
We are all out there chasing distance, as you know, Debbie. That's the big thing everyone talks about. How can I get more distance? And you've got a wonderful YouTube channel that's got so many great videos about how we can fix the things going wrong in our game. But you also point out where we have a power leakage. How can we go out there and shore that up and get more distance?
Well, as I mentioned earlier, check your grip first. Make sure you are not putting the brakes on during your whole swing. If you're squeezing so tightly and you have all of that tension, it will literally slow the club down. So that's one. Look into, these are basic fundamentals. Look into your weight shift. Are you turning and loading on that rear leg? And then, the ground force is a big key. Are you pushing off of that ground as you rotate your hips forward? When you talk about the mechanics of the swing and the sequencing, that's a big key. Rory McIlroy, he has the fastest hip rotation coming forward, but then he is also the quickest to stop it. It's kind of like, imagine, Chris, if you had a wet rag and you snap it at somebody and you're going to just snap them in the leg, right? So that's picture that with Rory's lower body and all of us. The sequence is we unwind the forward swing to come forward after you load up, unwind from the lower body up. So we do that with the hips. Now, the key is to do it in the right order. People do it at different paces on the professionals. And so it may not be the same pace, but the order of the sequence, that sequence is key. So unwinding from the lower body and then that stable lead leg is key. So we make that full shoulder turn, load up, unwind, use some ground force and press from those legs, those big muscles that we have. They say glutes are king in golf, so that's a big part of it. And then that nice stable lead leg is going to help you. And by all means, follow through, finish your swing, let it swing all the way to the finish. Of course, you may need some fitness to help you with that as well. The flexibility you need, the stability in certain muscles, the flexibility in others. It's all so valuable to your golf swing.
Speaking of flexibility, one of the things that most of us don't do is get our bodies ready by stretching as we get there. We're always in a hurry. A lot of times we're rushing to the first tee. We just barely got there in time. We don't have an opportunity or spend the time, whether it's still when we're at home or once we get to the golf course, of stretching and warming the body up. And then we go out there and we play and we wonder why we don't start playing well until we get to about the fifth hole. Talk about some quick things that we can do to warm our bodies up to prepare to play our best golf.
One of the things to make sure you do is have your stretching when we're thinking of stretching, all of the stretching before an event is movement. It's called dynamic stretching. So you want to make sure you get through all of the golf muscles, and even like little wrist turns are really important. Getting your shoulders, like rotating them up and back and then go the other direction, down and forward. And as we go through, you want to do some kind of rotation for your rotator cuff. So what I do there is I hold the club out in front of me. One hand is facing down, the other one facing up on the club, just straight out in front of me. And the one that's facing up, I go up and over. And so that gets the rotation part. And it just pause for a second and come back. And so key to get the rotator cuff muscles. And then the lower back, doing some turns back and forth. And it's all movement. Of course, your hips are key, coming up and around with each leg a few times. And then a lot of people don't pay much attention to your ankles and calves. So doing toe raises, with your toes straight out, and then your toes out to the sides, and then your toes in facing each other. Do 10 of each of those, and then certainly ankle circles. So go one direction, the other direction, and then toe lifts up and down. Your ankles, you know, need to be flexible there because there's a lot that goes into the ankles. We want to start that stretch, you know, make sure we have every part of the body from up by your neck to your wrist, to your shoulders, hands, back, and hips and legs, all the way down to your calves and ankles. And it's all movement. Make sure you're not, you know, just holding a stretch. You can do that afterwards, after your body's warmed up, after golf. You know, if you're not heading right to the 19th hole, maybe you can take a minute and do a little bit of stretching if you notice you're tight in some places. The other thing that's really popular these days, and I've done this oftentimes, is Golf Forever. Scottie Scheffler endorses this, and they have a great program, and there's an app, and you can bring the system. It's a bungee cord and a pole, basically, that attaches, and you go on the app, and you put golf warm-up, and you just follow it. So that's a really effective system as well.
You've got a playing lesson about the importance of forward shuffling and a wonderful tip for how we can practice it. Talk about why our hands should be slightly ahead of the clubhead at impact and the drill that we can do to achieve that.
Well, I like to say, let's avoid the scoopy poopy. You will hit the ball so much farther, so much more solidly if your hands are slightly ahead at impact, right? We start them there in the setup. And we want to keep them there. I think there's too many amateurs whose hands get behind them and mentally, like, they're trying to hit the ball a little harder. And it ends up being a scoop. So if any of you out there hit the ball too far, too high, and not far enough, you know, this, you want to definitely do this drill. I like to start right with the chip shot, like a chip and run shot. And I have my, I call it the professional anti-scoopy poopy drill, where you take your lead arm and put it all the way down on the grip, as far as you can. Let the grip run up your forearm. And then with your trail arm, hold the grip against your forearm. So your arm actually wraps around the grip and your forearm. And you can do some drills that way to get the feel of the solidness of impact of your back of your lead hand is solid and not breaking down and not scoopy at all. So it can start there. Then you want to get into more of a half swing. You can use an alignment stick, put it under your lead arm. If you do this properly, the alignment stick means nothing. It'll just be there. If you're a little scoopy at impact, you're going to hit yourself with the stick. So put it under your lead arm and do your regular grip, hanging onto it around your grip, and then hit some half shots. And then what you can do is just these half swings and have a rotation through impact. So we want your forearms to rotate. We just don't want the wrist to scoop.
Debbie, the post-shot negative reaction is something we all do. We do it from time to time. We've talked over the years that you've been a part of the show about all the negative self-talk that we do out on the golf course. The more we tell ourselves that we suck, the more that gets embedded in our minds. Talk about how dangerous our negative emotions can be and how it can impair our future results.
I love this question, Chris, because I would think, everybody listen up, like, would answer this question. Do you want to have a more positive experience on the golf course with better shots or a negative experience with tension and anxiety? You know, everyone will say positive, and that's in life too. You know, I have people raise their hand when I'm doing a corporate speaking engagement. Who wants to live a happy, positive life, or who wants to live a negative life? Everybody chooses positive. But then we all of a sudden talk ourselves out of it by beating ourselves up. And so it's a huge, huge key on the golf course, because when you are so angry and you get frustrated, you get a rush of adrenaline and cortisol. Cortisol is the stress hormone. And then it will create tension in your body. You'll probably start breathing more shallow. And it will impact your rhythm, tempo, and timing. It actually even impacts how you view the next shot. You're more creative when you're in a positive mindset and you're being proactive rather than reactive and in a stressful situation, we need to be creative on the golf course a lot of times. So we want to make sure we're in a peak state of mind. The other thing, if I ask people, how many of you want more confidence? Everybody wants even more confidence, even your most confident golfer. Well, if you're constantly putting yourself down and telling yourself you suck at the game, your brain is actually listening, right? It's, you know, even if you ask a negative leading questions, why do I keep three putting? What's wrong with me? Why can't I hit it as far as other people? Your brain is trying to answer that question. You don't really want to know that. You want to know, how can I make two putts or less? How can I make more birdies? How can I hit the ball farther? What can I do to score even lower? You know, what if we're asking those types of questions? And when the ball goes somewhere else, interrupt the negative, interrupt the frustration and say, wow, that's fascinating that the ball went over there. Or isn't that interesting? You know, to drive a flow state, which is being totally in the present moment, curiosity is a trigger. So if you're like, that's interesting, let's go see where the ball is. And you're curious about the next shot that you may have to create, you will actually invite a flow state, which is a more present in the moment, deep focus state. And you want to have that on the golf course.
Debbie, in your September newsletter, which people should go sign up for by going on your site, golfpositive.com, you talk about how September is the time for refinement and renewed focus. Why is this the right time of the year for those things?
Well, if we are part of the world and part of nature, and we are all one in a sense, right? So we're going to see this time as we look outside, the leaves changing colors, right? It's a transformational time. If you're playing golf in the north, you know, it starts to get a little cooler, right? That changes. If you're playing golf in the south, thankfully, it starts to get a little cooler because right? It's been so hot and you may have rainy weather. So not only is the weather changing, nature around us is changing. It's time for you to change. Take something to the next level. Ask yourself, where can I create a transformation at this time of year? Where can I grow? What do you want? What are the goals that you want to achieve? And then look at that area and say, who do I need to be to get to the next level? Because it was Albert Einstein who said, you can't change the problem with the same level of thinking that got you in the problem in the first place, right?
Yes.
That created it, I think is the way he said it, that created it way more elegantly than I just said it. You know, you can't. So you've got to shift your mindset to get to the new next level. So if you want to, you know, break 100 for the first time or 90 or 80 or 70, you want to get to a single digit handicap, there's a mindset shift that needs to happen to help you get there. It's time for your transformation. And it starts with, Chris, awareness. What are your current thoughts and emotions and behaviors? And what's serving you and what's not serving you? So take that time to examine, get the awareness first. The truth will set you free. A huge quote that's been out there. The truth will set you free. Just be honest with yourself. Don't judge yourself for it. Just be honest. Where are you exactly? And then start asking, what can I do to take things to the next level in whatever area you want to grow in? You know, maybe it's, you know, having fewer putts. Maybe it is hitting the ball farther. Maybe it's lowering the handicap. Maybe it's winning the club championship or qualifying for USGA event or for the tour. You know, wherever it is, start that transformation now with awareness.
Debbie, just a couple more before I let you go. And I know you've only got a few spots left open, but you host a great trip to go watch and support the U.S. team at the Solheim Cup, which takes place this time next year over in the Netherlands. How can people go out and scoop up the last couple of spots?
Yeah, go right to my website, Debbie, D-E-B-B-I-E hyphen O'Connell, O-C-O-N-N-E-L-L .com. So Debbie hyphen O'Connell .com, and it will scroll up. You'll be able to see it. It says fan experience in the Netherlands. And that whole trip will include the Solheim Cup tickets. And we are so excited for this event. You know, we arrive Monday, September 7th of 2026, and help everybody get settled in and relax. The next night we'll have our first round of golf. We play golf, the Golf Positive Cup, and then we have a welcome dinner, DJ and dancing. We have a ball, and then we have day two of the Golf Positive Cup. And on our third day, we will have sightseeing opportunities. So on Thursday, sightseeing opportunities, and then, of course, the opening ceremonies of the Solheim Cup. And from then on, we really focus on the Solheim Cup, except our closing dinner. But we'll have, it includes the transportation. Basically, you have to get there, and that's it. We take care of the rest, and it can be a really fun, relaxing trip. So those of you who love golf, you love being a fan, you love like rooting for your country, you like the Olympics and dressing in red, white, and blue, you like the screaming and yelling of a football game and the quietness of a golf match, it's all there for you. If you've never been, I highly recommend it. And I'll be going to the Ryder Cup over in Bethpage. That's not far from me. I have a media pass because I do a radio show every Sunday morning called Tea to Green, and we'll be there doing it live just in, what is that? It's a week and a half away or so.
Right.
So, you know, that'll be very exciting as well. So we have Ryder Cup and then Solheim Cup next year. It really is. If you've never been to either one, get it on your bucket list.
So remind everybody before I let you go about how they can follow you online, follow you on social media, plus listen to your show, Tea to Green.
Yeah, I'm on Facebook. Just search Debbie O'Connell or Debbie O'Connell Positive, or, and then I have a Golf Positive page if you're real more focused on golf tips and mindset tips. I'm on YouTube, as you mentioned earlier. That search Golf Positive, Debbie O'Connell Golf Tips, probably. I'm on Instagram as Debbie O'Connell there. Debbie, I think there's an underscore O'Connell, something like that. But watch for me. Those are my main platforms, and LinkedIn. And that's where I'll be on LinkedIn. I do a lot of the great tips and articles. And also I'll be talking more and more about how to use golf for business with the Business Golf Live program coming up October 8th through the 10th as well.
Debbie, I can't thank you enough for coming back, like I say, for a 16th time and spending time with me and our listeners this week. You're awesome. You're just absolutely not just one of my favorite guests on this show, but like I've told you before, one of my favorite people on the planet. I can't thank you enough for doing it again with me this week.
Well, thank you, Chris. I think the world of you as well. And you ask the great questions. You obviously are an incredible host, and I'm so glad more and more people are hearing about you and tuning in, because you are just amazing at what you do and a terrific person as well. Thank you so much. I'm already looking forward to number 17.
Me too. Best of luck, Debbie. Good luck, and I'll catch up with you. Hopefully we get this privilege again with you soon.
Thank you, Chris.
See you, Debbie.
Bye.
That's the great Debbie O'Connell, folks. Just a wonderful individual. Now look, I mean, she's a top 50 LPGA instructor. You don't get that on accident, right? So you know what a great instructor she is, what a great teacher she is, and the great tips that she has. Please go out there and subscribe to the YouTube channel. You'll see exactly what I'm talking about. We barely scratched the surface of the wonderful things that you're going to go out there and see on that. Check out again her website, Debbie_O'Connell.com or -O'Connell.com. You can find her on Instagram at Debbie_O_O'Connell is where you'll find her there. And look, if you want to go have a great time and support the U.S. team at the Solheim Cup, you've got to go out there and check out the trip that she hosts. I mean, I've seen the pictures and the videos and all of that from the years that Debbie has been a part of the show and the trips that she has hosted, and the people look like they're just having a ball. So why wouldn't you? Go root on the U.S. team. Go have yourself a great go. Be in the Golf Positive Cup, and then a wonderful trip alongside of all of that. So go check that out as well. Like I say, Debbie is one of my favorite people. We'll get her back on the show again, hopefully a little bit later on this fall. Coming up next is a guy who's one of the all-time great golf journalists and writers, Hank Gola. I'm excited to have Hank as part of the show. He's going to make his next On the Tee debut with me. Before we get started, I want to remind you about our friends over at On Point Golf and their out of this world On Point Golf Ball Marker. And if you don't have one, folks, you really need to go check it out at onpointgolf.us. Get the number one ball marker in the game of golf. On Point is the only three-dimensional ball marker out there. With alignment technology and a removable coin that is approved to use according to the rules of golf. As you know, putting is all about line and pace. Mark your ball with OnPoint, engage with your three-dimensional ball marker, and have more confidence in your line, execute the putt, and you're going to lower your scores. Do what the likes of Jim Furyk, PGA professionals, and amateurs alike are doing now. They use the number one ball marker in golf and they lower their scores. You know Ken Duke and Thongchai JD. They won for the first time on the PGA Tour in 2023, and they were using an on-point ball marker. Get yours at onpointgolf.us and make more putts. And oh, by the way, you can also customize the removable coin for any club, event, or corporate outing. They make really great tee gifts and custom products. That's also going to help lower your score. I use on-point ball markers. Mine is black and gold, 3D black golf ball with a gold line down the middle to help me line up my putts. It's like having a 15th club in my bag. It's helped my game. Why wouldn't you let it help yours? Again, onpointgolf.us. See what I'm talking about. Order yours today. I also want to remind you about our wonderful friends over at Squares Golf.
So Nick here. What if there was a golf shoe embraced by hundreds of thousands of golfers, celebrated for its stability, comfort, and distance? What if this shoe earned the title of most technologically advanced golf shoe by Sports Illustrated? And what if the company behind that shoe spent the last year perfecting a brand new category of golf footwear? Well, the what if is here. Introducing the all-new Pro S 2LT by Squares, a new class all of its own, the perfect blend of lightweight comfort and stable performance. You'll notice the difference. Change your shoes, change your game. Squares.
I also want to give a special shout out to our wonderful friends over at the Pittsburgh Brewing Company. Their pumpkin ale is back, folks. It's the number one selling pumpkin beer in Western Pennsylvania and incredibly popular everywhere their beer is sold. Why? Because it's everything you love about beer disguised as everything you love about homemade pumpkin pie. Go online to pittsburghbrewing.com to check that one out. Plus, there are other great beers, including the Blockhouse Blueberry Wheat, along with my family's favorites, Iron City and Icy Light, of course. Check all of that out and everything else they've got going on this fall by going online to pittsburghbrewing.com. Okay, now making his Next on the Tee debut with me is Hank Gola. Hank has had an amazing career in journalism. He started writing for the Herald News in Passaic, New Jersey, and the Daily Record of Morris County. He's also covered golf, football, and soccer for the New York Post and the Daily News. He's won several awards from the Golf Writers Association of America. In 2008, he won an award in the Daily Features category for an article he wrote about a guest on this show, Megan Francella. He won three more awards in 2009 for the article he wrote about the battle between Padraig Harrington and Sergio Garcia in the PGA Championship, plus his articles about the U.S. winning the Ryder Cup, let's hope that's some foreshadowing, and his story about the mind of Tiger Woods. More recently, in 2018, he was the recipient of the Lincoln Worden Award for Golf Journalism from the Metropolitan Golf Writers Association. He's written four wonderful books, and among them is The Inside Story of the New York Giants' 1986 Super Bowl Season, wrote that alongside of Jim Burt. Tiger Woods, an illustrated biography from when Tiger was a young player out on tour. And the most recent one is Ryder Cup Rivals, The Fiercest Battles of Golf's Holy Grail, which I happen to have my copy of right here. It's a fantastic read. And I'm honored that I get to spend some time with him this week here on Next on the Tee. Hey, Hank, thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you for inviting me on, Chris. I'm very happy to be here.
So, Hank, let's start by going back to the early days for you. And what initially drew you to journalism and being a sports writer?
It's pretty funny because when I was a kid, I wanted to be the broadcaster for the Baltimore Orioles. So I would everything I did, you know, just shooting baskets outside, I'd do play by play on myself, you know, or whatever. So I always wanted to be involved in sports. I wasn't a very good student, but I don't know how many people would be interested in this, but in the history class when I was at Garfield High School in New Jersey, which I did write a book about too, City of Champions. You missed that one. That was the story of the 1939 national championship team in football. But my history teacher encouraged me and said that she's, you know, I could write. And of course, I like sports, so I combined them. And there you go. I became a sports writer.
All right. So I got to ask you, because I'm from Pittsburgh. The show is available on the Pittsburgh Tribune Review. You say you wanted to be the play-by-play guy for the Baltimore Orioles.
Yeah.
So our teams, 71-79, right?
Don't mention those two. Yeah, I know. Okay. You got me. But, you know, 66 was one of the greatest years of my childhood because, you know, I'm living in New Jersey with a bunch of Yankees fans. And, of course, I happen to be an Orioles fan. I, you know, there's a story why I became one. It had to do with my Little League love. But anyway, Orioles finished first place. Yankees finished last place. And the Birds swept the Dodgers in the World Series in 66. I made the Little League All-Star team, hit 400. And, you know, you can't get better than that for a 12-year-old. So
no kidding. Good for you.
I've been paying for that ever since. Yeah.
Okay, so having this whole thing in mind, I, like you, grew up wanting to be a baseball announcer. We used to play this game when I was a kid called Dice Baseball, and we used to record those things and announce the game as we were playing it. So when you go back to the beginning of your career, landing your first job at the Herald News and the Daily Record, how did you do that to get your whole dream rolling?
Well, I was a sports editor on my college paper in Montclair State. I was the Montclairian, and I just answered a want ad for part-time help at the Passaic Herald News, and I started, you know, answering phones for all the correspondents of the high school games that were being called in, and I guess I did a pretty good job of that. And I was still in my senior year of college, and the assistant sports editor said, you know, would you like to cover the Cosmos? And I really didn't do anything. Hadn't even played soccer or was interested in soccer, but they were moving from Yankee Stadium to the Meadowlands, and they had come out after all the New Jersey suburban papers and said, "Look, we'd like to take your guy on the road, all expenses paid, if you just cover us." So I was 22 years old, and I was making $150 a week, and I was traveling first class with the Cosmos all over the place.
So
wow. It was a pretty good deal. And I'm telling you what, that was a great beat to cover. Great bunch of guys. And I look back on those days, some of the best, most fun I've ever had in the business.
You're obviously one of the all-time great golf writers now, but none of us get where we are all on our own. Were there people along the way that influenced you and shaped your writing that helped you get to where you're at today?
Yeah, sure. At every level there are. I mean, I remember there was a guy at the Passaic Herald News, my first newspaper, Bruce Keenan. He was the desk guy. Unfortunately, he ended up a very tragic death. He was an alcoholic and all of that. But he was kind of a wasted talent because you know, I would read his stuff from years before when he was covering baseball for the Passaic Herald News. And it was really, really good. And, you know, he ended up kind of wasting his life on the bottle. And, I mean, he was a mentor, but at the same time, it was like, hey, you know, you just push. Don't allow yourself not to use your full talent and abilities. So that was kind of one thing that stood out.
One of your books is about the 86 New York Giants, and a couple of guys on that team are great friends of this show. Mark Collins, Leonard Marshall have been on.
Oh, yeah.
When you did the research and put that book together along with Jim Burt, were there things that you learned about that 86 team that surprised you?
Well, I did cover that team, so I kind of was in on all the shenanigans that were going on. And, you know, I would just turn the tape recorder on with Burt, and he would just talk. And I kind of wanted to do it in his voice, not mine, so it would come across as a Jim Burt book, not a Hank Gola book. But you know, I mean, some of the behind the scenes stuff that went on was interesting. But I kind of had an inkling into what was going on because Burt was telling me this stuff all during the season. You know, we would get together, and that's one of the reasons I wrote the book, because I knew there were these great stories behind the scenes that were happening during the 86 season.
Well, your latest book, Ryder Cup Rivals, traces the history of the matches going all the way back to 1927 and the matches that were at Worcester Country Club. People know about the tremendous impact that Tiger had on the game and the money that he brought into it as a result of how well he played. But talk about the 27 matches and the impact that Walter Hagen had at the time, initially bringing money into golf.
Well, of course, Hagen was the ultimate showman and the first practitioner of gamesmanship. You know, the whole kind of the seeds of the Ryder Cup were, you know, who was better, Europe or Great Britain or America? Great Britain had been, developed the game, owned the game, and they were producing the best players. But as the turn of the century neared, a lot of British exports moved over to the United States and started, kind of the Johnny Appleseed of the game over there. And then America started producing its own players. So by the time of the Ryder Cup came around, the first one was 1927, although there was an unofficial Ryder Cup in 26, it seemed that the United States was taking over the mantle from Great Britain, and the matches were being played like, you know, which team, which nation owns golf right now. And Walter Hagen was the first professional kind of independent contractor, because everyone who had been a professional golfer was more or less tied into their clubs at the time, particularly in the UK. They were kind of, they were owned by their clubs. Their clubs told them when they can play, when they can't play, what tournaments they could play. Hagen never was a member, never was a professional at a club as others were, and basically was out on his own. And of course, I think most people know the story. 1920 at Prince's, which hosted the British Open, because of the kind of aristocratic history of golf in the UK, amateurs were allowed to change in the clubhouse, but professionals were barred from the clubhouse, can only change in the pro shop and use the one hook that was available. So, of course, Hagen wasn't really big on that at all. So he rented a limo, a Daimler-Benz limo, and a chauffeur, which was parked in front of the clubhouse every day. And that's where he changed. Royal Sink Ports in 1920. So, he was he was the first golfer to make $1 million. And of course, his favorite quote was, "I never wanted to be a millionaire. I just wanted to live like one." But he was something. He was the first trash talker. He was the first guy who got tried to get under the skin of the opponent. He was the real deal. And of course, no one else really matched him until Servi Ballesteros came along for Europe, and was kind of the showman and the practitioner of gamesmanship on that side.
Yeah, so let's take that and move several decades farther. The war by the shore in 1991 certainly felt like at the time that it was a turning point in the matches. The U.S. had lost 3 in a row after having gone 12-0-1 in the previous 13, including 91. The U.S. would then win 3 of the next 5 before everything went completely south after that. But we all remember Azinger and Seve battling it out in their foursome and four-ball matches on Friday, the gamesmanship that went on between the two of them. Bernhard Langer would go on to miss a 4 or 5 footer on 18, which would have halved the match against Hale Irwin, but that ended up giving the cup to the U.S. But talk about why that was such a turning point for these matches.
Well, of course, Jack invited the Europeans in, or laid the groundwork for them to come in. Basically, in 1977, told Lord Derby, the head of the British PGA, like, look, we could keep doing this, and we'll be happy to come over here and kind of kick your butts. But if you really want it to be a competitive thing, you got to bring in Europe. And Derby thought kind of long and hard about it. At first, he was kind of insulted, but then the more he thought about it, he says, look, yeah, if the Ryder Cup is going to be be sustained and to become a really big thing, which it wasn't in 1977, Jack is right. And Europe came in. It took a while, but eventually they did take over. I mean, they won in 85. They won in 87 at Muirfield Village with Jack as the captain. And it was almost like the Americans weren't taking it seriously up until then, and then all of a sudden they were falling behind. So 91 was a very big kind of crossroads. It was also the year of the Gulf War, and Dave Stockton, the American captain played on that kind of patriotism angle, brought out camouflage hats and what have you. And kind of the Europeans were really happy with that whole thing. And they said, hey, look, we were part of the coalition effort at war. We had troops over there as well. And then in the days before the day before the matches started, the PGA of America had a big party. Both teams were there and had a highlight film of Ryder Cups. And the Europeans are watching it, and it's all American highlights. It's like, wait, what's going on here? So, you know, that fire was stoked early. And then Seve, who really, I mean, he always felt that he wasn't embraced fully by the PGA Tour, by American golf fans when he first came over here, even though he had won the Masters and was obviously one of the greatest players in the world. Had kind of a, you know, chip on his shoulder against the Americans. So that played into it. Zinger was, you know, kind of a gung-ho guy too. So they kind of came across swords with a couple of rules issues over a ball that Seve said was scuffed and wanted to take out and what have you. But, you know, it came down to just a really contentious week, with the American fans maybe going over the line somewhat for the first time. And it came down to that last putt, the last match, Longer and Irwin. And, you know, Longer missed the putt. But as I wrote in my book, he had two spike marks in his line. He read it with Peter Coleman, his caddy, and it was kind of a little it was a right to left line. And with the two spike marks in it, they were discussing it, and they said, "Look, let's just hit it firm and take those spike marks out of play." And he missed the putt. If those spike marks weren't there, he probably would have made the putt, and Europe would have won the cup. So, an example of some of the crazy things that have happened over the years. Longer actually had made similar putts in, I think, two out of the three previous holes. So it was not a choke by any means. It was just a crazy set of circumstances that that led him to miss that final putt and give the Americans the win.
A very similar thing happened in 1999. After 91, the 99 matches might be my favorite. We all remember the U.S. being down 10-6 going into the singles matches on Sunday. Ben Crenshaw's great speech at the Saturday press conference following that day's matches. He told us that he's a big believer in faith and that he had a good feeling about this. We remember Justin Leonard's incredible putt that ended up deciding things. The European team probably remembers more the U.S. celebration when that putt dropped, while Jose Maria still had a putt that could have had the match. You talk later in the book how the 2012 matches were miracle or meltdown, and I think you could have applied that same thing to these matches. Which one do you think it was for 1999, miracle or meltdown for then?
It wasn't as much a miracle. It was a meltdown, but I would put the blame at the feet of Mark James, the European captain, for two reasons. First of all, the reason Ben Crenshaw said he had a great feeling about Sunday was he probably got a look at the European lineup. And if you remember, Mark James had left his three rookies out of the entire lineup the first 2 days, and he was putting them in fresh on Sunday. And not only that, he lined them up in a row. He lined them up 3, 4, 5 in his lineup, like dominoes. So Lehman and Sutton won the first two matches, get things going. They were Crenshaw's two horses. He said, you got to win these things. Westwood and, who was the second guy? I can't recall off the top of my head. But they were kind of exhausted. They had played every match during the week. And then now you've got in the three hole, you've got Jarmo Sandelin against Phil Mickelson. In the four hole, you have John Van de Velde against Davis Love. And in the five hole, you have Andrew Coulthard against Tiger Woods. I mean, he just set them up to fail. And it went down. It went boom, boom, boom. Now you have five straight wins. And, you know, the avalanche was on. So we get to 17. And Leonard had been trailing that match against Olazabal most of the day, but Davis Love actually went out there and kind of was trying to give him a pep talk. His match was over long ago, and he trying to say, look, you're going to get in this. You're going to get in. He's going to give you an opportunity. Well, sure he did. And on 17, of course, Leonard makes that long putt. I was there. I was kneeling. I was, you know, inside the ropes, trying to give the fans a good view over my head. And Leonard was lined up directly with me. I got to tell you what, if there was no one else there but me, he would have told me to move because I was stacked directly in his line. That's how lined up I was with him. And to my left was one of the American wives. And as soon as that putt dropped, she was out of there like Usain Bolt out of the blocks. I mean, she was on that green like it was crazy, you know? What the hell? And like everybody followed after that. She just started the whole, you know, one little snowball starts an avalanche. That's what it was. I mean, the hot dog vendors were out there. Everybody was on the green. And of course, Olathabal had a putt left and they all trampled over his line and he didn't make the putt and the U.S. won. And there was a lot of fury about the conduct of the U.S. team and the U.S. crowds because they were pretty rough. It was a Boston crowd. They were pretty rough, and especially on Colin Montgomery. But here we go. And again, Mark James. I mean, I don't think he had his team prepared for what that European team was going to face from the Boston crowds. I mean, I always said this, if you really wanted to get them ready, take them to Fenway Park, put them in the bleachers with the Yankees in town and say, okay, this is why you guys are going to be up again. You know, it's not going to be the Augusta patrons politely clapping while, you know, you make your putt. It's going to be a little different. These are Boston fans here. I don't think they were prepared for it. I think, and you know, looking ahead, of course, they will be prepared for it from the whatever New York nuts might be there for Bethpage. But I think that whole thing came down to Mark James as European captain just not doing a very good job, and of course Crenshaw just, you know, I mean, with him it was sacred, it was mystical, it was Francis we met across the street, and all the ghosts and everything else that were on his side, and I think he. He got that through to his players, and it was kind of fun. It was, I mean, you could really feel the electricity and the passion of the Ryder Cup in 1999 for sure.
So when you look ahead a couple of weeks to this year's tournament at Bethpage and the New York fans that you mentioned a moment ago, and the U.S. team needing to get things back in line and needing to win the cup again, essentially facing the same European team that they faced in 2023. What's your expectation for what we're going to see?
Well, I think the Europeans have a better, stronger roster. I think they're deeper. I think the Americans have a lot of young and experienced guys. I also think that Keegan Bradley, you know, looking back at 2012, when he was paired with Phil Mickelson, he was born to play in the Ryder Cup. And I think he was also born to captain the Ryder Cup. So I think some of that enthusiasm, a la Crenshaw, a la Paul Azinger, is going to filter down to his team. And Rory McIlroy mentioned this. He said one of the hardest things to do is to win a Ryder Cup on foreign soil. They've done it already. Rory's done it already, 2012 in Medina. But they do have a stronger team. I think it's going to be a little different Ryder Cup because I think the premium's going to be on driving the golf ball far. And Bethpage, You got to go long there. There's no other way to do it. And that's kind of atypical of Ryder Cups. Ryder Cups have been, especially the golf courses, have been usually set up with the emphasis on strong iron play and short game, especially putting. So it's going to be a little different. We'll see who has the advantage. But again, I think on paper, Europe has a stronger team. I think the Americans certainly have the advantage with the home crowd. And they can do a lot. That crowd could carry you a long way. And again, if you keep that crowd quiet, like the Europeans managed to do at Medina on Sunday, they could turn that to their advantage too.
Hank, before I let you go, let our listeners know, how can they go out and get their own copy of the book, plus follow you online and on social media?
Very easy. Well, you could go to my website, www.hankgola.com, and there I have links to who's selling the book, But who's selling the book is Amazon, Thrift Books, Barnes & Noble, Books A Million, all the regular booksellers online. So you could order it that way. Your local bookstore might be selling it. Not sure. So the easiest way is just to get it online. And to follow me on social media is, we have I'm president of the Met Golfers Association, and we do have a YouTube channel. So the Met Golf Writers Association YouTube channel is probably the best way to follow me. I'm also on Twitter and all that other stuff too.
Well, Hank, I can't thank you enough for taking time out of your busy schedule to come and be a part of the show, talk about the book, and give us some of the inside scoop. You're fantastic, my friend. I hope we get this privilege with you again soon.
Oh, that would be fun. Maybe we could do it after the Ryder Cup. I'll be there. Yes. I'll be taking it in at Bethpage, see what happens.
I look forward to it.
Thanks, Chris.
Take care, Hank. All the best to you and your family. We'll catch up soon.
Okay. Bye-bye.
See you, Hank. That's a great Hank Gola. G-O-L-A is the spelling of his last name, hankgola.com. And folks, this is a fantastic book. It's a great read. If you are a fan of the Ryder Cup, the inside stories that you get, some of the things that you didn't know about, and then going back all the way, like I say, to 27, and you're learning about all the things that kind of built this up to being one of the great, as he mentions, the holy grail of golf, getting that Ryder Cup and getting to hold that trophy. When you learn about the things that went into it, when you learn about how it started, when you learn about, he talked about Mr. Nicklaus bringing in the rest of Europe. When you learn about all of those things and then some of the ins and outs of some of these matches that were pivotal to what, who won and who lost and how it happened and the excitement of the crowd and all that stuff. It's a fantastic read. I can't recommend it highly enough. Go out and get your copy. And then hopefully we get this privilege of having Hank back on the show. We'll do a little retrospect for what happened this year. So I look forward to catching up with him hopefully in a few weeks. All right, my friends, it is time for me to put a bow on part one of this week's show. Big thanks again go out to Debbie O'Connell and Hank Gola for being here and making this part of the show so much fun and so educational for me to be a part of. I hope you liked it. I hope you learned a little something and you enjoyed the last hour or so. Come back now for part two because Paul Olinger, comedian and host of the Reasonably Happy podcast, is going to be here. Talk about learning some things about ourselves. Boy, Paul is just fantastic. And the positive vibes and the number of smiles that are headed your way in part two, thanks to Paul, is going to be off the chains. Fantastic. You're really going to enjoy him. So please come back, press play for part two of this week's show. And folks, as I say, each and every time we get together, my biggest thanks go out to each and every one of you for being the greatest supporters in the history of podcasts. I appreciate each and every one of you so very much. Until next time. Hit him straight, my friends.
Thanks for joining Chris again this week on Next on the Tee. We hope you enjoyed the conversations as much as we did. Please share the show with your golf buddies and be sure to follow it on Trib Live or your favorite podcast app so you never miss an episode. Thanks for pressing play and being part of the journey. We'll see you next week, right here, where the best minds in golf share their stories.